Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Oh, hello, welcome back to the New Books Network. This is Shuwan. Today I'm very happy to invite Dr. Liu Yu to join us to talk about his newest book, A History of Competitive Gaming. So the first thing I want to do is to invite Dr. Liu to introduce himself to us.
Hello, Shu. I'm very glad to be here and to join your podcast. So my name is Zhou Xiang Liu, and I'm an associate professor in the School of Modern Languages, Literatures and Cultures at Maynooth University, Ireland. Yeah, my research interests include the history of sport, Chinese history, nationalism and national identity.
Thank you so much for your introduction. So my next question is that I want to know what's the reason you take interest in the promising field of history of video game and esports?
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. So there are several reasons. First, it's my hobby, my childhood memory of playing all these games, Nintendo and Sega. It's a good memory. While second, my background is sports studies, and nowadays I focus on the history of sport. That's my key research area. So I think it's an interesting and timely topic. From an academic perspective. So before I started the project, actually, I had a quick exploration on the current publications on this topic, because game studies is quite new compared to other established subject areas. Many of the publications on esports actually focus on the business side, or some focus on the legal side. And the social side of this activity. There are rarely some, in terms of history of esports, it is more or less an overlooked topic. So I decided to try to understand the history by myself. And also I think it's a good opportunity to turn this into a comprehensive book to explore the full history of esports from the 1950s to recent days. Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer again. So next thing, let's go to your book. So my first question is about the first chapter of your book. So I want to invite you to talk about the historical origin of video games.
Yeah, so it all started back in the 1950s when the first generation of modern mainframe computers began to rise. They were built in laboratories in universities in the UK and the US. Computer scientists, they began to use these computers, try to figure out what we can do with these great machines. So one of the possibilities to use these machines to make games. So actually, when you look at the history, Alan Turing, who is the founding father of AI and the modern computer technology himself. He got interested in this area, so he tried to develop a program to play chess. So it was designed as an AI program in the beginning to let the computer play chess game against a human component opponent. So later, Turing's colleagues and other scientists in the UK and America also joined this great invention to produce all various kinds of games. But most of the games in this early stage, we're talking about the 1950s, early 1960s, most of them, they are table games like chess and TikTok and all these basic games. And then from the 1960s onward, late 1960s, early 1970s, with the development of the technology, then they are now by the late 1960s and early 1970s, they began to use CRT screens to show what's going on, right? In the past, it's only a typewriter. You type, the typewriter will give you the results of the calculation. And then with all the screen, CRT screen, they can display various images and on visuals, videos. So scientists, they also used this mainframe machine to create the so-called real video games with video. Right? And the, some of the early games, for example, this, they are more or less like simulators. They simulate billiards game. You play that in the pub, right? And also some scientists, they created tennis for two. That's the name created in 1971. So it was designed as a game between two players, and they use a controller and to control the bat and then hit the ball. So that's the beginning of all these video games. We can see that in the very beginning, many of the games actually they were designed, they simulated sports, either table games, mind sports, we call that, right? Another kind is real sport, either recreational sport or competitive sport like tennis. So entering the 1970s with the development of technology, again, computers, we now have much smaller computers. So instead of in the laboratories, it's the mainframe, huge computers, huge machines. Now computers become smaller and smaller and more power efficient and faster. And more capable of running various programs. So students in universities in the US, especially in the computer science areas, and also researchers in the US, they began to use this modern, not modern computer, but the second generation or third generation computers to create more games. So we have a various diverse genre of games or diverse range of games were produced in this period, including sports games, shooting games, RPG games, we're talking about role-play games and strategy games. And naturally, people began to use these games to organize competitions. So the games they choose at first is a game called, it's a space war shooting game. So the idea is that let's play this game. There are spaceship inside that each player controls a spaceship to see who can destroy each other first. And then that's the idea. And then in 1972, I think that's the first ever competitive gaming event was held in Stanford University's AI laboratory with around 20 students and researchers participated in that event. So I would say that's the beginning of what we're talking about today, the esports or competitive gaming. Yeah.
Okay, thanks so much for your reviewing of the early history of video game and its evolution in the interaction with the development of table game. So now let's talk about, after talk about the early history of video game in a general sense, let's talk about the rise of competitive gaming when the power of Atari phenomenon, Pac-Man fever, and the Nintendo craze swept the world in the 1980s.
So after these early inventions, I mean, games from laboratories, right, by students and scientists. Then by the second half of the 1970s, commercial video games began to rise. We're talking about Pong, for example. We're talking about Atari. We're talking about other companies that produce these early games. Ping Pong is one of the pioneers, and that's even before Atari. And that game was designed as a kind of, you use a TV to play the game, and it's, you don't need a computer actually. You use a simple console to control the images on the TV. So two players, one each of the player control a patch, a ping pong patch. Then there's a bouncing ball in between, and then the two players can compete. And then Atari, based on this idea, produced the famous Pong. And then other companies also joined this campaign to produce various commercial games, expanded from Pong variants to all other kinds of shooting games and strategy games. So by the late 1970s, or actually from the mid 1970s, major companies, game companies, especially video arcade companies, they began to use a competition to attract players. For example, in 1974, one of the first commercial video game event was organized by Sega in Japan, and they invited players across Japan to join and to play to see who can get the highest score. And so at that time in the 1970s or in the early 1980s, it's the competition is all about how to see who can win the highest score by attempting a high score on a particular game. It can be any game, can be a puzzle game, can be a platform game, can be a shooting game like Space Invader, one of the most famous game at that time, and can be Donkey Kong as well. Donkey Kong is a platform game produced in the early 1980s. So we can see the market started to take shape. A video game market, at that time it was called the golden age of video games by the early 1980s. We have Europe, and we have Japan, and we have America. So if you look at the landscape, most of the big companies, they're either American companies or Japanese companies. In Japan, we have Nintendo, Sega, Taito, and in America, we have Atari and Midway and all these big names. So what they did is that these companies, they began to host competitions on various games. It's very clear. The purpose is to attract players, so more players can play their games. It's for promotion purposes, and then they will normally give small gifts to winners at the time. It's only a T-shirt or a token or some small souvenirs. It's different from today's esports event. You're talking about millions of dollars for winners. At that time, it was very, very different, right? So that's the early development in the by the early 1980s, before the great video game crash of 1983. Yeah, the early commercial games and game competitions.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer again. So after talking about interwoven history of a commercial video game and competitive gaming in the 1970s and the 1980s. Now let's switch to the question of the reconstruction of video game industry in the context of widespread arrival of PC and internet, along with the formation of some popular esports genres.
Then after the crash of 1983, actually the North American home video game and arcade game sector saw a decline. And at the same time, companies from Japan, especially Nintendo and Sega, they continued to invest in video game industry, and they began to produce those big names consoles, for example, Nintendo NES and Sega Master System, Sega Genesis, and then in the early 1990s, Nintendo produced the Super Nintendo, and Sony also joined the competition. So we see many Japanese-made consoles and games flooded into Europe, into America, and also America gaming industry also began to recover by the in the second half of the 1980s. Now the gaming industry, we need to look at the structure. it's a three-pillar industry. You have home game consoles like Nintendo NES, right, and Sega Master System, and then you have the home computer sector, and then the third sector is the video arcade market. So we go into those arcades, those shopping centers, or these entertainment centers to insert a coin and then try to play the game. The three sectors supported each other and forming a huge industry by the early 1990s. So what happened is that in the early 1990s, we see esports or competitive gaming developed into different directions. Especially with the rise of fighting games. We are talking about in 1991, Capcom released Street Fighter 2, right? So the difference between these fighting games and the first generation or the early commercial games is that they pit players against each other. So when we talk about Donkey Kong, the 1980s big names there, or Space Invader, right? All these games, you play by yourself, right? You try to attempt high score, and then the system will record the score and show you there's even a kind of a list of high score players, and the motivation comes from this I want to be the best of the best. So if I can achieve the top score, then I can put my name on the system. So other players, they can see it. So number one, number two, number three, we can put our own names there, initials there, and followed with a score. That's the big motivation. And in terms of competitive gaming events or gaming tournaments, it's all based on that concept. You achieve high score, then you are the best in Japan. How much score you achieved in a particular game can be any game, right? And in the US, we have the three top players. And then we invite all these players together to see who is the international champion. So it's more or less like a modern Olympic Games, from local level to regional level and to national level and to international level. And in 1990, Nintendo then organized a major competitive gaming event, the Nintendo World Championship. So that's how they organize the event. They invite players from all over the world, try to attempt high scores, play NES games like Super Mario, Tetris, and all these, and Contra, all these famous titles. And then they organized regional or state competitions across America, and then finally a grand final to see who is the best player. So that's the traditional way for competitive gaming. Started from the 1980s all the way to the 1990s. And then come back to the fighting games, started in the arcade, like Street Fighter 2 and Mortal Kombat, produced by Midway. These fighting games were normally played between two players locally, in these local arcades. And the idea is that there are two or three rounds of games, and if you win, right, and you can see your opponent in front of you. It's not to achieve a high score, but it's like you beat him up in the game. You win that particular game against a real human opponent. So that totally changed how gaming competitions were organized. Or played. It's no longer attempt high scores. So local operators, arcades, or Capcom, the companies, when they organize fighting game events, it's more or less like you organize a tennis event, or a real sporting event. So you invite, say, 30 players. So these 30 players will play each other, and then only 15 of them survive into the next round. And then the semifinals, six players, then the finals between two players. So that makes the competition very, very intense and highly attractive, especially for audience. So you think about the high scores. Yes, it's interesting, but you see the player play against the computer and sometimes you get bored, right? But for fighting games, it's so diverse. You can invent so many different skills in Street Fighter series games. And you see the real emotion of the two competitors. And when they lose the game or when they win a point, and you can see that, that's a game changer. Then moving to the computer game sector, and the personal computers began to rise. So the major difference for esports or for this competitive gaming area is that now gamers, they can connect two or more PCs, we call that, computers together, either use a modem to... At that time, there's no broadband, so they used modem, use a cable to either use a cable to connect two or more computers, or you dial into the telephone network and then use that to connect to a distance computer. Then in 1993, we have Doom, right? The great FPS game. That game became one of the first PC computer FPS titles to support this multiplayer mode. It means two or more players can join a network and compete against each other. Again, the important thing I want to mention here is that it's similar to the fighting games. It's they pit players against players instead of against the AI to compete for high score. But what made Doom unique is that it's not only between two players. Now, it can be four players. And then later versions or other similar games like Quake and other FPS games, they pitch four or more, even 16 or 32. And then by the late 1990s, we had Counter-Strike. Right. Most of the gamers would know that title and have that memory of competing against two teams compete against each other. And then in addition to that, we had real-time strategy games like Warcraft and then Red Alert, Command and Conquer, and then Red Alert. And in 1998, we had StarCraft. So all these games, strategy games, is also based on the similar concept. They pit players against each other, sometimes between two players, and also up to eight players can compete on the same map instantly at the same time. So with the development of the internet, by the late 1990s, we see the horizon expanding. In the past, in the early 1990s, when we talk about Doom or Command and Conquer, it's only normally between two players, right? Locally, and all use a cable. You use telephone network to dial into another computer and you compete. So by the late 1990s, we're talking about LAN parties. We're talking about local area connection games. And you go into a certain location, you see multiple PCs linked to each other, and then a big crowd actually join the competition. And then it's the internet is changing everything. So it's no longer confined to a physical location. So you sit at home and then you can connect to, for example, two or three or even more players in the same game to compete at the same time. So that was a game changer. I mean, technology changed everything. Also changed the way games were used for competition.
Thank you so much for your discussion about how the technological, infrastructural, and cultural change influenced the evolution of video game and the configuration of competitive gaming. So after that, let's go to the new millennium. So for next question, I want to invite you to talk about the formation of modern esports industry and the rise of non-profit esports organization and the governing bodies in the early 20th century, or 21st century, I mean.
Yeah. So esports, this term, actually started to be used since the late 1990s. And then moving into the early 2000s, we see this rapid development of the esports, so-called esports industry. Especially surrounding several games, StarCraft is one, and then Counter-Strike, right? And Warcraft, that's another game. And many of the events were actually organized by the game publishers, like Blizzard and other major game companies like EA. EA, they make sports games, right? They organized FIFA and NBA basketball games. And also Japanese game companies like Sega and Nintendo, all this, and Sony, they also continue to organize similar events. We see more investment in this area. I think the reason is very simple, because there are more players, and more players are interested in this newly rising way of play and way of competition, players against players, this kind of competition. So companies began to invest into this area. And at the same time, we saw the rise of esports governing bodies, organizations, either at regional, local, regional, or international levels. They also began to organize major gaming events with the sponsorship from game companies. It started at small level, regional level, and then expanded into a big scale events that involve thousands of people at a time. And the big name at the time was WCG in Korea. Right, WCG games annually held in Korea. That initiative actually was supported by the Korean government, by Samsung, and by the major industry players there. And the purpose is to use these competitive gaming events to boost the IT industry, to get more people play and to participate and to promote the computer industry. And at the same time, we see the rise of non-profit organizations. So these organizations actually were, most of them, they were created by gamers themselves and not for profit. When they organize the event, it's for charity. So it's different. Even you look at the games they used, and they use old games from the 1990s or the 1980s, the NES or Sega Genesis times, the 2D games, right? And they still play high score games to attempt high score, or some of them they try to attempt to finish a game and to see in the shortest period of time, in 2 hours or 3 hours. Normally a game would take us 10 hours, but they try to figure out a way to finish it in 1 hour to see to create a new world record. But all these are kind of for non-profit purposes. It's a hobby, it's nostalgia, get the feeling, right? So it became very diverse even within this esports area, or esports industry, developed into different directions.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer again. So after talking about, I want to say, the emergence and the evolution of competitive gaming and esports in the extended period, so now let's talk about the current situation of esports. So I want to invite you to discuss the obstacles and the challenges facing esports now.
Yeah, okay. So we've briefly covered the history, and I think the last chapter of my book focuses on these challenges for future development and the obstacles and the industry is facing at the moment. I have several points. The first point is sustainability issues. Because if we look at the industry itself, when we talk about players, normally we compare it with traditional sports like soccer and basketball and track and fields, swimming, all these games. In esports, which we call pro players, professional players, right? They are very young. They are normally between the age of 18 or 22. And by the age of 22, 23, you see many players would retire. It's a competition for young generation. So this raises a question for the sustainability of the industry. Also, if you look at the industry as a pyramid-like industry, yes, we have professional players, we have semi-professional players, then we have amateur players. If you look at the pyramid, it's a perfect-shaped pyramid. How many people can get into the top to become professional players? And among these professional player circle, how many can earn money? Can earn big prizes like 1 or 2 million or even 10 million super big prizes. That's only a few every year, not so many. But people really look at the bottom of the pyramid or the middle of the pyramid to see how many semi-professional players or professional players in this pyramid and what's the future for them and how about their life. There are many reports and real stories about players, professional players around the world. Actually, they receive a very low wage and the salary is not good, and also it's not sustainable for them. And sometimes the company pay them very little amount of money and only lasted for less than 2 years, 1 or 2 years, a short period of contract. And if they can't get into the top level, if they can't win prizes at international events, then where's the future? So that's my concern. And another thing is the IP issue and antitrust issues. Nowadays, we see most of the events, they were organized by game publishers, copyright holders of this game. Again, we compare esports with traditional sports. Who owns the copyright? In traditional sports, anyone can organize a basketball or tennis or swimming competition at any level. And nobody is going to charge you for copyright. Is it? But for esports, no, the platform used for competition is game produced by companies. These companies own the copyright. So you have to get permission from the game companies. It's okay for local level. Say, I have a couple of friends, 10 or 20 friends, we organize the event. The game companies won't bother that. But when it becomes big, say, I want to organize a national competition, and then investment is involved. Commercial advertisement is involved, and then game companies may ask, yeah, that's their intellectual property. You need to pay a certain amount of money to be able to use the game. And sometimes it's the publishers decide whether to go ahead with these events or not. There are several examples I'm not going to talk here because the time limit. Yeah. And integrity issues, we talk about cheating and gambling and drug issues, right? Like in traditional sports, esports players are facing similar situations with performance-enhancing drugs, for example, and cheating during competitions. And some players they were bribed by gambling companies to lose in certain games and to make profit. So these are all the problems we're facing, similar to modern games. Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer, and I really appreciate your talk today about your fantastic book. So at the end of our episode today, I want to talk to my audience. So for my audience, for my listeners, if any of you take any interest in the history of video game in the promising field of game studies, and even you just quote nerd, quote fans of esports of video game, I highly recommend you consider buying a copy of Dr. Liu's fantastic book, History of Competitive Game, which is one of the best books about this topic. So thank you so much for listening our talk today. Thank you. Bye-bye.